Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. This is episode 113, which we're recording on November 22nd, 2018. Politicoast is the BC politics podcast. Tell us what you think of the show by leaving a review or get at us at social media. Most importantly, help us build the show by throwing us a couple bucks a month at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott DeLaneboom.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
And I'm Shannon Waters.
Welcome back. As always, we're listening to Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikov as our intro music. On today's show, we have you here to talk about this very important issue of the river otter that's invaded the Sun Yat-sen Gardens in Vancouver here. Sound about right? You've missed this story, I bet, entirely.
I have limited knowledge of the Chinatown otter, mostly based on what I have seen on Twitter, because I've been spending a lot of time on there the past couple days, but why don't you fill me in?
Oh, there basically is just some river otter that snuck into the gardens and is now eating all the koi carp and being adorable. That's about all that story.
Well, and now the city is divided into Team Otter and Team Koi.
Oh, man.
But I think you're probably busy trying to keep up with what's going on in the legislature, and that's what we'll get you to explain to us as well as we can all figure out.
Yeah, I mean, there are no easy answers at this point in time as to what precisely is going on. We know a little bit more than we did on Tuesday when Government House Leader Mike Farnworth's motion hit the floor, but not a whole lot.
Well, before we jump into that, we have to plug BC Today as always.
Right, so let's do that.
It's British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for that free two-week trial to get Shannon's unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. All right, so the news today is that I think you were stonewallied out of the speaker's office.
Yes. So today started off in very dramatic fashion. We had a visit in the press gallery from some very senior BC Liberal caucus communications staff who told us that a scheduled announcement from Leader Andrew Wilkinson about ride sharing and supposedly proposed amendments that the Liberals are going to put forward on that bill was not going to be about ride sharing and was not to be missed. So we all trooped down to the opposition leader's office in the legislature. And there were Wilkinson and House Leader Mary Polak, who shared with us a signed affidavit about a meeting that took place on the evening of November 19th between herself, Government House Leader Farnworth, Green Party House Leader Sonia Furstenow, Speaker Daryl Plekis, and a constitutional lawyer. And the bombshell there, essentially, or the piece of information that the Liberals were hyping up to share with us, was that during that meeting, during this discussion about an RCMP investigation into legislative clerk Craig James and Sergeant-at-Arms Gary Lenz, during this discussion, so the RCMP are investigating, and there are two special prosecutors that have been appointed, Plekis decides to float the idea that maybe his special advisor, Alan Mullen, should serve as the Sergeant-at-Arms while Lenz is on administrative leave, which is a very odd thing to do. Both Farnworth and Polak said that Plekis' suggestion was rejected. Both of them used the word firmly to describe the rejection that that suggestion received. But so this is how we started our day at the press gallery. I hadn't even had my first cup of coffee yet.
Oh.
And we're already dealing with legal documents and strange sort of claims from, or suggestions from, Speaker Daryl Plekis.
Yeah, so I think that's helpful to jump right into the middle, and then we can kind of see the complexity and bizarreness of the story that has been this week.
It has definitely been bizarre. I am still the new girl in the gallery. There aren't many members who have been around for less time than I have, but in speaking to my more senior colleagues, They've never seen anything like this. None of us have ever seen anything like this. Keith Baldry mentioned that it's his top five crazy BC poly moments.
That's a big list.
Yeah, that includes like the RCMP breaking down ministers' doors and things like that.
Yeah, Keith's career as a legislative reporter is longer than my lifespan. And this issue this week still makes the top five as far as he's concerned.
So yeah, let's go back to the beginning, or at least when the story broke, which was Tuesday around question period, when the NDP House leader put forward a surprise motion to suspend Clerk of the House Craig James and Sergeant Arms Gary Lenz. And before I jump into that, I should just quickly mention that Gary Lenz was actually a neighbor of mine growing up. But
Oh, really?
Yeah, like literally kind of the block over, like my family and his family are friends. It's weird.
Huge conflict of interest. You can't report objectively on this story.
Yeah, so it's super weird to see his name in the news, and especially around all the drama happening here.
Yeah, so question period is basically my favorite time of day. I know every time I come and talk to you guys, I plug how much I enjoy question period. So I have taken to watching it in the chamber. It makes it a little more difficult to live tweet because I have to do it on my phone rather than my laptop. But you get to see question period, the reactions that people have. You get to hear some of the heckling that goes on, which doesn't make it into Hansard. Mm. Hansard doesn't include heckling unless it becomes a substantive part of the discussion. And so I've taken to watching question period in the chamber, and question period on Tuesday wasn't particularly, there were no fireworks really. It was nothing super special. And then towards the end of question period, Keith came in and was sitting in the chamber and indicated that somebody had told him that something interesting and significant was going to happen after question period. So normally we all file out, those of us who are watching in the chamber, as soon as question period is done, because once the House duties are assigned for the remainder of the session, whether it's in the morning or the afternoon, it's a good time to grab ministers or MLAs that you're looking to speak with. So right as soon as question period ended, we're all kind of looking down at the floor, and there were a couple of MLAs who kind of gestured at us like, you guys need to stay here, don't leave. And so we stayed, and things proceeded as normal at first. The clerk asked for orders of the day, and Government House Leader Farnworth gave them. They were debating the speculation tax bill in Committee A, and I think the House was on the environmental assessment plan. And then as soon as Finance Minister Carol James and finance critics Tracy Reddies and Shirley Bond had left the chamber, Farnworth immediately adjourned debate on the bill and moved this motion to suspend the clerk of the House and the sergeant at arms pending an investigation. And basically that just set the press gallery off, right? So we exited the chamber. Everybody's coming down from the upstairs gallery downstairs to ask Farnworth what is going on and to fill us in. And he had no information for us. He just said the motion speaks for itself. And that is what set off the craziness that has been this week that feels a lot longer than a week. I can't believe it all just started on Tuesday.
So for people who aren't keen legislative or parliamentary watchers, the clerk is basically the person in charge of the nonpartisan bureaucracy. Is that roughly right? Kind of the inner workings behind the scenes of the House?
Yeah, he was described to us as like the CEO of the legislature. It's a nonpartisan office. Clerks are typically appointed for life, and they serve to advise sort of anybody in the House about proper procedures and legislative rules and all things pertaining to the sometimes sort of arcane goings on in the House. I myself haven't had a lot of contact with Craig James, but my colleagues think very well of him. And certainly the clerks in the House have been a huge help to me as I've been sort of finding my feet as a political reporter. We actually spoke to Craig James before he was escorted out of the building, and he really did seem shocked. He said he had no idea what the allegations were about. He said he would be seeking counsel. He said he wasn't feeling like cycling home, so he was going to be catching a ride with Gary Lenz as they were leaving the legislature and would come back for his bicycle later. So that was kind of a sad little detail there.
And then the sergeant of arms, I guess, is more the head of security and otherwise ceremonial roles.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, he does carry the mace, and he is responsible for the security of the house and the precinct, as well as security issues facing, say, constituency offices out in the wider range of the province.
And I guess other than your brief comments you got from James right after or as he was being walked out of the house, I guess by Victoria Police, which was its own weird little side story, we haven't really heard anything else from them or what they're being investigated for.
No, there has been no discussion around the substance of what prompted this investigation. We've been told it has to do with their administrative duties, and nobody wants to speculate further. We've been told that this could interfere with the investigation that is ongoing. All of the various members of the government have basically said that they can't discuss any more than they already have. And basically what we know is that there's this investigation that's been going on for months. Two special prosecutors have been appointed. The RCMP continues to investigate with advice from those special prosecutors. And the investigation has to do with the administrative duties performed by James and Lenz.
And yesterday, the Post reported that the allegations might involve fraud and theft of public funds.
Yes, there is an article about that containing that information. I have no way to verify it, and nobody else has really discussed that article or sort of the potential sources or the implications of what those sources may have told the reporter who wrote that story. So yeah, I don't know really what else to say about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's out there, that's possible, but certainly for most reporters and the public now, we don't know.
Yeah. Well, we do know a little bit more that happened today. At first, it had sounded like this investigation was kind of started by Plekis, and it wasn't clear the timeline, I guess, initially. I was trying to keep up with it, and it sounded like, oh, maybe in the summer, like September, he tipped off the RCMP. But as far as we can tell now, this has been ongoing since January.
Yeah, so when we were first introduced to Plekis' special advisor, Alan Mullen, and basically nobody in the press gallery knew that the guy existed before, like, Tuesday.
And that's saying something.
Yeah. So we were asking him, you know, when did you start working here? How much money are you making? What are you doing? What's the scope of, you know, your job, your responsibilities? And he told us that he was hired in January. He said he was, you know, advising Plekis that he had some questions about, not necessarily questions, but concerns about, like, being able to represent his constituents while speaker and just, you know, looking for advice because the speaker's office is supposed to be nonpartisan, nonpolitical. And of course, Plekis had been an MLA and so, what you know, wanted to make sure he was fulfilling those duties. So Mullen was hired in January. We have since learned that part of the reason that Mullen was hired in January was to help the speaker investigate some concerns about James and or Lenz. I'm not entirely clear if it was one or the other at that point, or both of them. And Mullen told us that when he first started, the investigation was a very small part of his job. Obviously, that eventually changed. In August, both the RCMP and the Victoria Police Department were notified about the investigation that Plekis had been having Mullen conduct. And in that same time period, a constitutional expert was consulted. This was something that James mentioned to us before he was escorted out of the house, that there would have to be grounds on sort of a constitutional basis for his removal. Eventual removal, I guess, pending the criminal investigation and charges or whatever. So a constitutional expert was consulted in August. On September 28th, the RCMP requested a special prosecutor due to the scope and nature of the investigation they were conducting. And on October 1st, two special prosecutors were appointed. That's very unusual. I've never heard of a case before that involved two special prosecutors. And special prosecutors are typically only brought in for sort of very serious or sensitive cases. I mean, obviously, if there's something criminal going on that involves top officers at the legislature, that's going to be a huge deal in and of itself. But the fact that there's been a special prosecutor, two special prosecutors appointed to this case, likely indicates that it's something pretty substantial. So, yeah, that's what we know about the timeline so far.
And then, well, today, as we hinted at earlier, everything just got way crazier when Mary Polak came out with that affidavit, which in itself was a little weird. Like, that normal that affidavits get signed for press conferences?
I have never been given an affidavit in a press conference before, and that extends past my experience as a legislative reporter. Nobody's ever handed me an affidavit. I have a feeling that the affidavit was included to quell concerns about partisanship. The BC Liberals' relationship with Speaker Darrell Plekis is rocky, to say the least.
Understatement.
For those who don't know, Plekis is a former BC Liberal MLA. He was kicked out of the caucus last fall for taking the Speaker's chair.
And according to Matter of Confidence, he was also the one with the knife in his hand that ended Christy Clark's career, it seems like.
Yes, he was sort of involved in that, which probably led him to consider the Speaker's chair. And anyway, so I have a feeling that the affidavit was included to prove that the Liberals were serious about this, that it wasn't just some scheme to try and get rid of Plekis. Mary Polak did say to us, you know, we asked, why are you saying this now? You wouldn't tell us anything yesterday. Why are you divulging this information now? And she said that she felt that Mullen's comments to the media warranted some kind of clarification. She was concerned about the appropriateness of him being the point of contact with the Speaker's office, and also said that during the meeting with the Speaker, with Mullen and the House leaders and the lawyer, that it was agreed that Attorney General David Eby would be the only person to speak on the matter. And so promptly having Mullen start holding news conferences, essentially, on the subject was unsettling. And Polak seemed to indicate she felt it was inappropriate for him to be doing that.
It's definitely weird. It reminds me of like a British parliamentary sitcom or something, or, you know, one of those kind of shows where
a yes minister
or in the thick of it, where they've just like added in a random bureaucrat who has like no actual mandate to start speaking, and you're like, who is this guy? And I won't ask you to comment on this, but there is a piece in the Abbotsford News by Tyler Olson that goes into who Alan Mullen is, and it talks about his somewhat long relationship actually with Darrell Plekis, including like when they were at University of Fraser Valley together. They knew each other through some of that criminology work. So it's not like he kind of just came out of nowhere. And I think that's where some people are feeling even more uneasy about this sudden relationship.
Yeah, I think that definitely plays into it. Mullen did admit that he knew Plekis when he was asked by members of the gallery. He said that they had worked together at the Kent Institute, which is a Corrections Canada facility in Agassiz. And he told us that he would describe himself and Plekis as friends. So he also mentioned, I don't know how significant this is, because as far as any of my colleagues at the press gallery or any of the ones that I spoke to today were concerned, they can't think of another speaker who has ever had a special advisor before. But Mullen was asked if there was any competition for his job. Was it publicly posted? Were there other candidates considered? And he said he was not aware of that. So it seems like he was handpicked by Plekis, who was possibly feeling like he needed a friend in the legislature, somebody that he could trust and really rely on. And so that may have been part of why Mullen was brought into the Speaker's office.
But in the end, he ended up kind of running what seems to be a very major investigation for nearly a year. And based on that Abbotsford News article, doesn't have a background in law or much of investigations besides like one or two he might have done while he was working at the correctional facility.
And this was a concern that was brought up by the BC Liberal Party leader, Andrew Wilkinson, both about sort of the secrecy of this investigation being conducted for more than half a year inside the legislature without anybody knowing outside of the Speaker's office, and also about Mullen's qualifications. I think there's a lot of frustration in the House right now with how little information there is available, both to members of the press gallery and to the MLAs themselves and to the public. But we're basically being told that that's the way it's going to be, and it could be for a long time.
So in terms of like who's in the know here, it sounds like obviously the Speaker's office and the House leaders of the parties, and that's about it.
I guess the RCMP.
Yeah, Attorney General maybe.
In terms of any information about the investigation itself, Yes, it's basically a half a dozen people who were in the speaker's office on November 19th. The House leaders, the speaker himself, Mullen, and the constitutional lawyer they were consulting.
Well, the one question I have about that meeting, because it isn't clear from an affidavit, which is very dry text, is Plekis makes this suggestion that Mullen become the new sergeant-at-arms. I can't read what the tone of that recommendation was, because if it was a, oh, here's just my friend, he's smart and helpful, he could do this job, kind of friendly suggestion, which is probably in bad taste, or was it more of a nefarious, I'm going to try and slide my friend into this cushy role that I just made available, which is what some of Twitter is going off about, and I don't know if you or anyone would actually know that.
I don't think we really have that information at this point in time. Mary Polak made very clear that she found simply the timing and context of that comment to be very inappropriate. They weren't talking about a successor to Gary Lenz, and the legislature has procedures in place to appoint deputies for those positions while both James and Lenz are on leave. We got the motion this afternoon from House Leader Farnworth to appoint Deputy Clerk Kate Ryan Lloyd to serve as acting clerk in James's stead, and the deputy sergeant at arms will serve as acting sergeant at arms in Lenz's stead. Like, there's a procedure for that. There's a line of succession, basically. And so Plekis's suggestion is just, even if it was sort of innocent and just sort of floating an idea, is still seems to be quite off base, because there was no need to suggest that. And Mullen wasn't going to be the acting sergeant at arms, sorry, because he's not the deputy sergeant at arms. Yeah,
it's also just weird and inappropriate in the sense that, like, that's a very senior position. You know, the person's in charge of security for this, you know, seat of government. And, you know, like, was it 6 years ago, there's like a major bomb threat and everything. Like, this is not just kind of one of those jobs you kind of
fall into.
Yeah. You know, put your buddy from down the street in Abbotsford into just cause.
Yeah. I mean, the optics on it are just not really good any way you slice it, I think. Even a sort of charitable interpretation doesn't look very good.
Well, this question is what's driving some of the liberal talking heads on Twitter to suggest Plekis should be immediately resigning, which might be a bit early to say, but it's not a good, you know, move by Plekis, and everything since Tuesday has been flustered by him.
Yeah.
In terms of comms.
I don't think we're at the point where he should be resigned, but there's definitely a stronger case than there was 24 hours ago.
Today did not make anything better.
So let's talk about the press conference you were supposed to have at 2 p.m.
Yeah. So the thing about the press gallery is, when things aren't busy, we all kind of do our own thing a lot of the time. I pay very close attention to what's going on in the chamber. My other colleagues might be working various angles on multiple different stories for stuff that's going on in the legislature. But when big news breaks, we operate as a pack, kind of. Nobody wants to miss out, right? So everybody is always worried about where everybody else is going and, you know, being the last one there and not getting a good angle so you can't get any photos.
This is a bit like elementary school.
We spent a lot of time hanging out in the hallway. It was very reminiscent of high school in a certain way. I mean, we do that anyways, but today was like an especially lot of time hanging out in the hallway. So we did the announcement with the Liberals, and then it was time for the caucus walk, which is where all of the NDP caucus come out of the cabinet room and they walk into the chamber. We were all hoping to talk to Government House Leader Farnworth, mostly to confirm that he agreed with Mary Polak's characterization of the meeting that had happened and that we had an affidavit for. And Government House Leader Farnworth, who is also our Public Safety Minister and Solicitor General, is a very crafty man and managed to make it into the chamber without coming across a single reporter's sight line. So we didn't get to ask him ahead of him ending up in the chamber. And so we, you know, we're looking for answers. And so he was kind of the speaker rather is the next person that we want to talk to. And actually, if I'm looking at my timeline here, so we tried to get Farnworth. Farnworth was in the chamber. So we waited until after question period. And then in a very sort of unusual maneuver by the press gallery, we attempted to question Plekis as he exited the chamber and went back into his office. And the speaker doesn't normally do media interviews. We don't speak to him very often at all in a formal capacity.
Yeah, it's a nonpartisan role that generally just kind of keeps everything in order and should be out of the spotlight.
Yeah, but we needed answers, like...
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, you have a legit excuse to be asking him questions right now.
Well, and even when we're going, you know, like, we know that House Leader Farnworth can't really tell us much, but we can't just not ask. We have to kind of push for the most that these ministers and public officials can reveal to us without, you know, breaching whatever levels of decorum or privacy or whatever are involved. So we asked Plekis, like, did you suggest that Mullen, you know, be the acting sergeant at arms? What is going on? And I'll quote him here because I just think it's important. He said to us, "I am not sure that you have the correct story here." Then he told us that at 2 p.m. he would offer a statement and answer questions from the press gallery. "I'm sure you will find it interesting what I have to say this afternoon," is what he told us.
Well, what did he have to say this afternoon?
Nothing. We did not speak to Plekis. After some slight tweaks to the time and the location of his statement to the gallery, he refused to speak with us and said that Mullen would be issuing a statement. And that is all we got.
And Mullen's statement, so, was not very long. And just to cut to the chase, he announces former Attorney General Wally Opal is going to be appointed as a second special advisor.
Yes. So we went from speakers never having had special advisors to one speaker having had a special advisor for 10 and a half months or something like that, to the speaker having two special advisors. And apparently I assume Mullen and Plekis will be meeting with former Attorney General Wally Opal tomorrow.
And Opal, it's reported, has agreed to this. So they've clearly been in discussion about this for, I don't know, at least 24 hours.
Well, and we were told both by Premier Horgan, who announced a government investment in making social housing more energy efficient, and was then questioned by members of the press gallery about things that did not have anything to do with that announcement. But Premier Horgan and Government House Leader Farnworth both told us that they understood that the Speaker's office would be receiving additional resources, by which I can only assume they meant Opal.
Apparently.
He is the additional resource.
So is there any indication what he's going to be specially advising the Speaker on?
Nope. Mullen said right up front, and I think you may both have seen it on Twitter, I said, you know, it's going to be a bummer of a newser when they tell you right off the top, "I'm not taking any questions." And that's exactly what Mullen did. He spoke to us for approximately 30 seconds, and then he backed into the Speaker's office and closed the door.
Classy.
So,
yeah, I'm sure we'll learn more from, hopefully, Opal tomorrow.
Well, I'm sure by the time this podcast is up, you know, five other things will have happened.
So that runs us through, I think, most of what has happened. Did we miss anything from the last, like, 72 hours that was important?
I don't think anything significant. I was somewhat impressed by the Premier's answer today. I asked him if he thought that the public had enough information about what was going on in, you know, the body that governs them. Democracy Watch has already raised some concerns about a lack of transparency. Mm-hmm. So I asked the Premier, I said, you know, do you think that the public is getting enough information, and do you think that the RCMP are being forthcoming enough given the situation that we have? I mean, people are talking about, like, democracy being destabilized, and there's definitely a lot of anxiety at the legislature. I'm not sure how much, you know, a lot of members of the public really care about stuff like this. And as Horgan pointed out, like, the legislature is still functioning. Mm-hmm. They passed several bills today. They're going through committee stage on others. You know, we had question period as normal. The legislature is still functioning. But at the same time, there's a lot of frustration about the lack of information and the constraints around that information being provided because there is this investigation going on. And the Premier said, "The good news is I don't know anything." and then he went on to elaborate, and I'm quoting here, "That is good news, because if there is going to be an impartial investigation, it has to be conducted with the same rigor that the RCMP would use in any other place." Which I kind of have to agree with. I mean, simply because it is the legislature doesn't mean that there necessarily has to be an additional level of transparency. I think the concern from a lot of people, particularly those who have worked in the House for a while, is that it can take a long time for investigations like these to get to the point where information is shared with mm-hmm. the public.
And so I'm assuming, because you mentioned earlier in that meeting, they decided that Attorney General David Eby would be kind of the voice of this investigation. I'm assuming he hasn't had anything to say beyond anything else that's out there.
No, Eby's taken the broken record position of simply saying there is an active investigation and I cannot comment on it.
Fair, I guess.
and so really have the other, you know, the House leaders, mm-hmm. basically everybody involved, except for Mullen, who feeds us information in dribs and drabs. It's very unsettled in the legislature right now, and it's going to be unsettled for a while. We only sit for 2 days next week. The House is adjourning early so that MLAs can attend an all-chiefs meeting. I think it's the BC Assembly of First Nations that is meeting in Vancouver on Thursday and Friday. And then we don't come back till February. So the House is out as of Tuesday until mid-February. And so it's going to be a while before things kind of, I think, go back to normal. And again, I don't know, we don't know how this is really going to play out, but it was one of those moments I was struck by something that another colleague of mine said on Twitter when talking about sort of what was going on in the House. And it's funny because we're both new to the gallery, so we get a lot of the it feels crazy anyways, but when you have people like Vaughn Palmer and Les Lane and Keith Baldry commenting on how crazy things are when they've been reporting for like 30 plus years, you really get a sense of just how insane things are. But this colleague of mine said, this is one of those rarest of days when you're keenly aware that the things you are seeing will be talked about for a long, long time. And I think that was very much the feeling of the gallery in these past couple of days.
So who's going to pair up to write the best-selling book on this, Sadra?
Personally, I really just hope that like Rob and Richard give this the matter of confidence treatment. I really enjoyed that book. And I came in at the very end of it. So for anybody who's read it, the epilogue is literally where I walk in the door of the BC legislature and start reporting. So I would love to see them write a book where I, you know, obviously I don't expect to mention, but where I know that I am in that place while things are going on.
Oh, Daryl Plekis's memoirs, when he eventually writes them, are going to be fascinating. But to maybe just come back to a couple of characters, and I don't think there's going to be much to say here, but do we know anything more about James and Lenz that might shed some light here? I take it they've been kind of closed-lipped since they left the grounds.
Yes, so James spoke to us. I seem to recall seeing at least one article that he declined to comment on. I don't know if Lenz has spoken on the record to anyone. Like I said, I don't have much firsthand knowledge of either of them, at least in terms of interactions. I mean, they've been in the House the whole time that I've been there. I know that they are both very well regarded by members of the press gallery. And everybody just doesn't even know where to start in terms of what this investigation could be about.
And then I guess the other character is Wally Opal, whose nickname was Stone Wally from his time as Attorney General, because mm-hmm. there are many videos of him really trying to shut the NDP down around, I think it was the BC Rail scandal at the time, where he just sat there and said, no comment, no comment, question period after question period. I think the only other thing that I know him from is he ran one of the missing women inquiries in BC, the Opal Inquiry. I think it was around 2011. As far as I can tell, he's widely respected, and it does give, I guess, Plekis some space for immunize himself from criticism from the BC Liberals, since he found one of the most popular Liberals, in a way, to kind of bring into his office.
I mean, a lot of people kind of laughed when we were told, and part of that was just the disappointment of the statement that Mullen offered us when Plekis had promised to speak to us and answer questions. But just a lot of people kind of laughing that, you know, Opal had been appointed. The whole nickname of Stone Wally, which I actually wasn't aware of until I heard gallery members mentioning it, struck me as interesting because I was told that he basically got that by saying no comment and saying there is an active investigation or the matter is before the courts, I cannot comment, which at the time was a rarity, but it's not anymore. We hear that all the time about all kinds of things, and sort of the scope of that response from ministers has expanded hugely since Opal was in government, which was almost 10 years ago. We are very often told that ministers can't comment before a matter because a matter is before the court. when really they probably could offer a comment. They might have to be a little bit careful about what they're saying, but it's almost used as like an excuse now. Like, the matter is before the courts, so I don't have to comment on it because I can just say that it's before the courts.
Well, if he's the first one who's made that a thing, I guess he's well positioned to keep this investigation as quiet as it's been.
Yeah, I mean, everybody is basically hoping for a speedy resolution. Obviously, we want the RCMP to do a thorough investigation, to really do their jobs, to do it justice. But we also want answers, right? I mean, it's very unsettling. It's very disruptive to have this situation in the legislature where there is so much uncertainty. And so the hope is that whatever is going on, it is resolved and made public sort of as quickly as is feasible and proper.
Well, I think that basically covers everything we wanted to talk about on this controversy.
Well, let's move on from there, because even when the legislature is blowing up with all of this craziness, the government keeps on ticking and other stuff comes out. So earlier this week, the ride-sharing details got announced and the NDP put forward their bill to bring in ride-sharing eventually.
They sure did.
This was, I guess, going to be the big story of the week, and I guess all the other legislation they passed and big announcements that will kind of rush through. Ride-sharing is something the BC Liberals have promised, the BC Greens have been really loud about, and the NDP has been
reluctant.
Well, they did say they would do it in the fall of their first term, which they didn't.
And what time is it now?
The fall of their second term, and it will be here for maybe the fall of their third term, which is the first criticism. The rest of it looks, I don't know, the devil's in the details and how you feel about Uber and things like that. It's more restrictive than pro-Uber people would like. It seems like the taxi industry is happy. There are possible limits, I guess, on the number of vehicles that can be out on there, so the government could cap the overall, and I think that's one of the big criticisms from the pro-Uber side, because they could just limit it to the number of taxis that are out there right now.
Or even, in theory, lower.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically have a very low cap on the ride sharing. And yeah, that absolutely has been the criticism, because I think half of what people are excited about with Uber isn't Uber itself as so much as breaking the taxi cartel. And this potentially doesn't do that.
How is Weaver responding to this, Shannon? Because I know BC Liberals are obviously very critical and they say this is failed legislation, but are the Greens satisfied?
It's ride failing is what they're trying to make happen.
Well, Weaver said to us that he did have some concerns. He's concerned about the timeline. He doesn't think that we should be waiting until at the earliest next year, this time next year, for ride sharing. He doesn't see the need for ride sharing drivers to obtain a commercial driver's license, which is something that is required of taxi drivers, also bus drivers, and I believe some sort of commercial passenger shuttles in the province are required to obtain this license in order to be a commercial driver. I don't actually know if there's any more cost associated, but there are some extra components to the testing. There's a medical component, and once you obtain the license, there are age-based criteria for having to undergo further physical examinations. You also have to be able to demonstrate that you know how to do a pre-trip safety check. And I think we were told that, you know, the driving test is a little more rigorous. So that's something that Weaver has in common with the Liberals, not feeling that the driver's license is required. Weaver had also said he doesn't see any reason for ICBC to need until fall of next year to develop insurance products for ride sharing. That was basically, Transportation Minister Claire Trevena told us that, you know, the disarray at ICBC had essentially meant that they haven't done any work on this at all since the government changed hands, and they need until next fall to be able to provide the insurance product. And so ride sharing can't hit the road until there's insurance for it. And so we have to wait for that. So Weaver essentially seems to agree entirely with one of the amendments the Liberals have proposed to the bill, which is the driver's license component. The Liberals have also suggested that private insurers could cover ride-sharing drivers and do so much more quickly than ICBC would be able to. I don't know what Weaver's thoughts are specifically on the private insurer angle, but he does seem to feel that ICBC could do something differently. And the third component of the amendments that the Liberals say they are going to propose is the supply management, essentially. The government is saying that the Passenger Transportation Board is going to determine how many rideshare drivers and taxi drivers and or a combination of the two are needed in all areas of the province, and will be handing out licenses appropriately. And they will possibly be setting some parameters on pricing, which is something that Andrew Wilkinson vehemently disagrees with. He believes that market forces alone should determine the cost, how much you pay when you get into, say, an Uber. And when we were talking to a spokesperson from Uber, he said that no other jurisdiction in Canada has restrictions on pricing. They require pricing transparency so that when you book a ride or get into an Uber, you know at least roughly what it's going to cost you, but they do not have sort of floors and or ceilings on pricing, which is something that we may end up with here in BC.
Yeah, it is all interesting. I mean, I know Quebec has some rules around, and out of all the provinces, I think Quebec would go the furthest in terms of, I don't know, socialisting it. I can make up words.
So in this case, if the Greens happen to like this stuff, can them and the Liberals team up to push it through?
Technically, yes, they could do that.
But practically, no?
There seems to be a lot of animosity between the Greens and the Liberals. I've heard both Andrew Wilkinson and Andrew Weaver use very strong language to describe the other person. I will add, it was kind of odd. Andrew Wilkinson came out with these amendments on Twitter earlier this week, actually on Tuesday when all hell broke loose. He had a tweet thread, and he actually called on Andrew Weaver to consider these amendments that the Liberals were proposing, and he tweeted out this thread. And then Andrew Weaver tweeted back and was like, basically said that they needed to take the discussion off Twitter, and his door is always open if Wilkinson wants to discuss, you know, shared priorities and common sense amendments to legislation or something to that effect. I don't foresee it happening anytime soon, but you never know.
Well, that I think covers up ride sharing. The other vehicle announcement this week was the one that got utterly buried on Tuesday by the Speaker's News, and it was rather unfortunate because it was one that Dan Vinyl-Wavich was actually at, and he's a past guest of ours who is from Clean Energy Canada. And so I was seeing his tweets kind of in the middle of everything else that was going on. And I was like, oh, poor Dan. But the important announcement he was at was that the BC government announced that we are going to move to 100% zero emission vehicle sales by 2040. So no more, I guess, what are they calling them? ICE, internal combustion engine vehicles for light duty cars and trucks to be sold.
Yeah, so basically your typical private owner vehicle is going to be zero emission by 2040.
So they're abolishing ICE, I guess, for light cars, but not commercial vehicles and heavy-duty trucks, right?
Well, that hasn't been announced yet. I mean, the interesting thing about this week is the government is basically starting to indicate to us what their forthcoming, yet-to-be-announced climate change plan is going to be. We were told that this was going to be a big part of the fall session way back at some point, and most of us, I think, assumed that it was going to be legislation that was introduced. It's now basically we've been told that no, the government is going to unveil its climate plan likely sometime in December. But the thing that we saw both on Tuesday and today was the government announcing sort of planks in that platform. They're also going to spend over $1 billion over the next few years retrofitting public housing to be energy efficient and to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see something to do with commercial transport and trucking very soon. We just haven't seen it yet, because in order to meet the climate change goals that the government has already legislated for itself and bring an LNG industry to BC, basically all our other emissions from all of the other sectors of the province have to go away.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting. It's a very ambitious plan. I don't think it's gotten the attention it really deserves yet, partly because we don't have the details. But for those who are interested, there was a piece that ran in the Globe and Mail, I believe it was on Sunday, written by Justine Hunter, that goes into sort of what this plan could mean and just how far-reaching its ramifications could be for the province.
Mm.
So anybody who's interested in sort of a deep dive into the upcoming electrification of British Columbia, I would recommend that.
Right, we'll find that and put in the show notes. I've seen a couple people push back on the electric vehicle announcement because they either say it's too fast or will stymie innovation or something else, but this is something that's part of a global trend, and I know a lot of European countries are really aiming for 2030, including conservative-led ones like the UK. Germany's, I think, got a similar goal. Norway's being a bit more ambitious with 2025. South Korea's going for 2020, so they'll be rid of...
Really ambitious.
Yeah, well, they may be well ahead of us. So BC is a very large, difficult to drive an electric car province when you don't have those service stations. So it is good to see. I mean, they did announce some bits of the electric vehicle, how we're going to get there, doubling the number of high-speed charging stations, starting to put some hydrogen fuel cell filling stations, which I didn't know many vehicles were still trying to make hydrogen fuel cells successful. I think it's a valuable thing, and it was something I was hoping to see in the climate plan when it came out, and 2040 seems doable, and I don't know. I'm almost a little disappointed it's not a little bit more optimistic, but I think this is the first province in Canada. And
it's definitely like it's a significant announcement. It's a significant shift. Weaver did point out he was at the announcement. He spoke to the crowd and he did say, you know, this may seem like an ambitious target for us to hit 2040, but pointed out, as you did, Ian, that there are other jurisdictions that have chosen sort of more ambitious targets, and also pointed out that for a lot of people, their next car will likely be an electric one. It's possibly something they're thinking about already, and that 2040, you know, for some people that's the life cycle of one car, for others it's maybe two cars, but it's not really that far away.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I guess it's good we now going to have a whole bunch more hydropower because it sounds like we're going to need it.
Yeah, it was very interesting because we got sort of this hint about the massive electrification that's going to need to take place when we got the final investment decision about the LNG Canada project. And the government indicated that Site C would be nowhere near enough. In fact, it would be likely less than half of the electricity that we will need for the electrification that is going to be required in order for us to launch an LNG industry. We then asked the government or the, I believe it was actually senior officials who we were not allowed to quote, asked them if the decision to continue with Site C sort of factored into this ambitious plan to electrify. And we were told that no, in no way was it related, but it's kind of difficult to believe that it didn't at least factor in somewhere. But yeah, we are going to need a lot more electric power, even than Site C can provide, in order to meet these goals and these changes that the government is intending to put in place.
Well, the last thing I put down in my notes to talk about in BC politics this week is that referendum that's still going on that we almost didn't have to talk about. The only things of note are that tomorrow, for everyone who's listening on Friday, this is your last chance to get your ballot if you haven't requested it already. Elections BC is reminding everyone. And that's assuming Elections BC doesn't do a postal strike extension, which they haven't said they will. So,
but they've hinted they might.
Yeah.
It seems to be going day to day at this point in time. They have said they're in daily contact, either with Canada Post or with postal workers. I'm not entirely clear on that. But just sort of monitoring the situation. At this point, honestly, I haven't cast my ballot yet. I intend to do it tomorrow and drop it off in person at a Service BC Center. And I think that anybody who has not yet put theirs in the mail, if there's any way you can just go to one of the special referendum offices that Elections BC has set up or to a Service BC Center, that's how you should cast your ballot at this point in time, just to be safe. I know for some people that's probably not going to work, in which case you should try and get it in the mail by tomorrow, if you can.
Yeah.
Because the ballots have to be, at this point, as of like right now when we're recording, Elections BC has said they need to have received the ballots by 4:30 on November 30th.
Yeah, so people should go to elections.bc.ca/referendum, and I'll put that link in the show note to figure out how and where to go and when to go and to make sure that gets in. The other bit of referendum news is right after we recorded on Thursday last week, or it was Friday midday, they released the updated numbers, as they've been doing, for the number of ballots that have come in every day. I think it was Friday when they actually first announced, oh, we haven't actually been releasing the full numbers, just the number we've screened, like the ones we've confirmed are good ballots.
So there's like a giant pile of them sitting in a warehouse somewhere, and everyone's freaking out that nobody's sending their ballots in.
So when it was like 7%, it was actually like 12 or 14%. And they are now up to 27% of the ballots have been received, which is still a very low turnout, but it's much more encouraging than the 15% that they've screened.
It probably means PI isn't going to beat us in turnout at this rate, just something.
I think the other takeaway, looking at the ridings that have particularly low return rate numbers or that have had so far, seem to be the ones that received their ballots last.
Yeah, I noticed Surrey seems to be trailing the province.
Yeah, Surrey and like Delta was in there as well, or at least one of the Deltas was in there as well. Now, most of the numbers hadn't crept much above 20% yet, which is still a bit worrying, but the trend at least seems positive. Like people are putting their ballots in the mail. We're still not out of the woods in terms of a decent participation rate.
Mm-hmm.
I would really, really like to see at least like 60% of people participate in this referendum. You know, my cynical little heart doesn't think we're going to get to that level, but hopefully we do have good turnout. And something that was pointed out to me recently, one of my colleagues is doing what he likes to call a chin stroker about the PR referendum that's going on, is that for young people who feel disenfranchised by the current system, unhappy with its results, and like they don't have much representation in government, this is the chance that they have to potentially change the system to something that is maybe more reflective and that they do feel enfranchised by. And they don't have to necessarily show up at a polling place, but everybody should vote, whether you don't want the system to change or you do want the system to change. Everybody should vote regardless. If you're a first past the post supporter and you don't want a PR system, you should vote, because if you don't, a very small percentage of the rest of the province could decide to change the system for you. Yeah, if you're a proportional representation supporter, I think one of the strongest arguments here is that BC may not revisit this issue again for a very, very long time. This is our third referendum on proportional representation in less than two decades. It's been almost a decade from the last time we voted on proportional representation, which was in 2009. And I feel quite comfortable saying that it will be at least a decade before we ever look at the issue again if this one fails.
Yeah, there's also been another poll or two. Mario Canseco of Research Co. found, like everyone else, it's effectively tied. Some people are trying to use the riding numbers and some of these polls to estimate where the vote is falling, and everyone keeps coming out with is very, very close. Maybe if you spin the numbers this way, PR is ahead by a point or two, or maybe if you spin them this way, first past the post is. But it really just emphasizes that every vote matters. And I know that sounds cliche, but it seems true. If you really want to get into the nerdy, wonky side of that, you can go over to Brian Brigue. I forget how to pronounce his name. We had him on the pod, though. At tooclosetocall.ca, and he's been trying to break that down. He thinks he may have an argument that PR is ahead, but again, it's so close that one assumption throws it off, and we won't know until mid-December-ish, I guess.
So how long does it take to count?
We've been told 2 to 3 weeks from the end of the referendum.
Oh, good. I'm going away next week, so I was worried I wasn't going to be able to watch the vote come in, but yeah.
No, and it sounds like, I don't know how the results will be delivered precisely, but the holdup seems to be the fact that part of the verification process for the ballots is a handwritten birth date and signature. So unlike the ballots themselves, those probably can't be scanned. They have to be actually verified by people, and so that would take a while.
Well, yeah, I guess that made sense. If they're screened percentage right now is 15% and they've taken in 27. I could see why it's taking a while.
It could be a Christmas surprise. I will be writing BC Today issues. I believe my last writing day will be the 21st, so the last issue would come out on the 22nd. So let's just hope we get the news before then, because I won't be writing again until early January.
All right. Well, you mentioned there's only a couple days left of sitting this session.
Two days
after Friday. So they rushed through a bunch of legislation today. Was there any other highlights? I know the speculation tax and the employer health tax passed. I think the Human Rights Commission passed.
The employer health tax passed a little while ago. The speculation tax passed today, so that was significant. The Human Rights Commission bill also passed today, which was significant. They actually passed a bunch of stuff. They ended up passing the Professional Governance Act, which will tighten oversight of the qualified professionals model that we have for evaluating the impact of natural resource development projects at the moment. And then they were working on the Environmental Assessment Act, which is basically a new Environmental Assessment Act, and the ride share bill. But I haven't looked at the final blues today, so I would have to get back to you on that one. The Human Rights Commission was a significant and a unanimous, although I know Ian has an addendum to this, a unanimous vote in the House, which we really don't see very often.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out if it was unanimous. I know Lori Thronis wasn't in there, and I will be writing up some things for the Humanist Association about his comments in committee where he was asking if David Eby would appoint a, I'm not going to say Bible thumper, but a Bible-believing Christian to the position to make sure he's protecting the rights of Christians. It was very strange. And then he was very offended that the report written by Ravi Kalone on the feedback he got kept talking about non-religious rights under the religious rights section, because the only people Kalone heard from were people that I was encouraging to give feedback. So that's not Ravi's fault.
It's your fault.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can blame Ian for that. Not a surprising tack for Thronis to take. He has spoken in the chamber about how he believes Christians are a persecuted minority in the province. So it's not exactly surprising.
And he was at the pro-life rally that was there, wasn't he?
Yes, he was a featured speaker. I don't use that term, but yeah, he was there.
All right. So that's the legislature as it stands and BC politics.
My hair is getting grayer by the day, I swear.
You have to dye it a new color.
Well, it does stand out in photos. I don't know if you saw that one of the front steps at the electric vehicle announcement, you can pick me out just by my hair color.
Well, let's pivot to our quick takes, and we'll start at the federal level. The Auditor General had a report out earlier this week that the Canada Revenue Agency is being a bit selective in its audits. They found that, the cruel way to put it is, if you're an average working class type person, like I guess any of us, or someone just making a general salary, you're going to be subject to probably much stricter rules than someone who maybe has offshore accounts. And the Auditor General specifically cites cases where, you know, some wage earner has to report certain files within 90 days, get the receipts in, but people with offshore accounts weren't having to get that information in some cases for years. And it just kind of gets at the fairness of our tax system.
Yeah, they also found that it varied widely by region too, so it wasn't even consistent across the country.
We're not treating all the rich the same?
Pretty much.
I literally just had this happen to me, so I kind of laughed at this finding. I was having filed my taxes for the 2018 year. I was recently told that I needed to provide, like, basically the hard copy of my moving expenses to actually move back to Victoria from Prince George to take this job for BC Today, and come up with my receipt for the ferry ride and also the moving company that I hired. And I think the like two meals that I bought along the way, which all added up to less than $3,000, including the moving expenses. So yeah, the CRA definitely wanted me to have my receipts.
Yeah, the AG points out that the CRA has waived $17 million in interest and penalties for some of those who are being audited. And this is despite, over the last 2 years, the CRA getting $1 billion to help crack down on tax evasion and compliance. The Conservatives are also quick to point out this all comes at the same time as the CRA is getting heavily criticized, I think again by the Auditor General, for not taking phone calls or being very helpful to people who are, say, in the process of an audit. So it all looks really bad and kind of undermines our, like, faith in the government institution that takes our money and is supposed to give it back fairly.
Yeah, I feel like the Panama Papers kind of put the kibosh on that belief for a lot of people.
Well, moving on from collecting money to spending money, the federal fall fiscal update is out. Real big headlines from there are apparently we want to do a little more corporate welfare, or at least make it easier for companies to deduct expenses faster from capital spending.
It looked like a lot of this is framed around the economy is doing well, the indicators all seem positive, but we're faced with a U.S. government that is willing to drown the government, cut all corporate taxes, and our only way to remain competitive is to try to offer some level. Obviously, we can't win a race to the bottom with Trump, but we have to do something. And so Trudeau is saying, let's go a little bit further into deficit to give a few more cuts and whatnot.
Yeah, and even so, our face value rate's actually still lower than the States. And yeah, I honestly don't have a strong opinion on this because it's really seems to me just how quickly the hit comes rather than spread out, just changing how quickly you can deduct stuff, not what the deduction is. But the other big news was apparently a media package that's going to be to have the full details announced with the spring budget, but sounds like there might be tax credits coming out for subscriptions to certain recognized media outlets.
Is this something you're following?
Kind of. This has been discussed before, although I don't know that it's ever gone to the stage of a government actually committing money. I am not going to hold my breath. I think there's, on the one hand, having worked in media for a couple years now in this country, I do think something needs to change because the corporate ownership of so many of our news outlets, of so much of our media, is problematic when it comes to not just the quality, the quality of reporting, not only because, sort of corporate interests are sometimes at odds with public interests when it comes to media coverage, but also because it can be very difficult in a small newsroom that is being just slowly whittled down by a company that's not willing to put more money into it to do justice to the community that you're covering. So on the one hand, yes, I think, media could use some, a helping hand from the government. The way that the government seems to suggest that they're going to go about it, to me, raises a bunch of issues as well, because, also when you're getting, when you rely on the government for funding and you're also covering the government, how critical are you really going to be of the hand that feeds you? I mean, it's the same issue that we have with corporate ownership of media, which could also apply to government subsidies of media. And I realize that we do have a public broadcaster, the CBC, that, relies heavily on government funding, but it's kind of a different beast, in my opinion, these sort of credits that have been proposed and how they would be handed out, I think raises at least as many questions and concerns as, not having them at all.
Yeah, and the credits are for eligible organizations, and if your concern is media concentration, that could very easily create a lock-in where the established media companies get a bunch of tax credits and everybody else doesn't and is pretty much locked out.
Yeah, just to back it up, the government has proposed three things in a page and a half, two pages in the middle of this update. First off is, I think, fairly uncontroversial, which is giving charitable tax incentives for news organizations. So nonprofit news could become a charity. Right now, because all our charity law is based on 19th century and older case law, they didn't think journalism was a public good then or something. I don't exactly know. Or maybe when the Magna Carta was written, when all this dates back to. Anyway, the US has a number of big foundations that support public interest journalism. Canada doesn't because we don't have the same structures. This would create that structure and allow you to donate to media groups that are nonprofit and charitable. That's fine. Then there's two kinds of tax credits. The first is this refundable tax credit to support news organizations, which I guess would be to help you just give money to, and in this case, it's both, I think, nonprofits like the charitable ones, but also possibly for-profit. So maybe your donation to Post Media could be a tax write-off.
Subscription, probably.
The second one is the subscription specifically. So there's a temporary non-refundable tax credit for digital news subscriptions. And I saw every podcaster in Canada I know immediately go, can I now have all my patrons deduct their donations? And the answer will probably be no, because as you point out, both of the eligible bits here are not going to be determined by the government, which tries to address the concern you brought up, Shannon, which I think is a legit one, but by some council of esteemed journalists and maybe execs, which then becomes that institutional, where's the room for new voices problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's, media is at such a weird space right now that I think it's difficult to even know sort of the effect that these proposals could have, especially when as yet the sort of specifics haven't really been defined. Certainly, there's a lot of independent media that I think are doing a really good job. We've got at least three separate outlets in the BC Press Gallery that you would describe as independent. I am one of them. And this is true sort of across the country in certain ways. People are finding solutions to the issue of sort of concentrated corporate ownership of media and the gaps that that has left in coverage. Honestly, I haven't had a lot of time to sort of look at the proposals. My impression of them is that, like I said, they seem to raise as many problems as they are likely to solve.
Right. And something I saw this Jen Gerson tweeting about earlier was that the Canadian media space isn't that big. It kind of everyone knows each other or, you know, a couple degrees off. And if you get a bunch of people together, it's going to be or have the potential for personal animosities and rivalries and everything to crop in there. Is that a concern?
I guess it could be. I haven't experienced a lot of that myself, but I do think that that's maybe a rarity. I worked in a relatively small market initially up in Prince George where, you know, there was competition. There were ratings that we were competing for and market share, obviously. But for the most part, like, it was a very collegial and collaborative atmosphere working there. And the same is true to a large degree of the Press Gallery. We often sort of work as a team and help each other because the job is really about holding our MLAs and the rest of the institution to account. That's not to say that, you know, people aren't proprietary when they have scoops and sources and stuff like that. But generally, it's fairly cooperative. But especially in certain sectors of media, I think you really do tend to have big personalities attracted to the job. And so I can see how, you know, in with big personalities in a competitive space and then being asked to sort of essentially compete for more funding, you could run into some issues there.
I know that's something that actually comes up in the arts and literary scenes in Canada, and they can be very cliquish. And so maybe that is something to be watching out for. I guess the only other thing to say on this before we move on is that the price tag on here was actually given out in the fiscal update, and it's $600 million roughly, which is not something to just ignore. So there is real money here, and I guess we'll see in 5 years' time if this has made a difference, and maybe when we have the government-funded Politicoast Empire, it'll be a different world.
I hope to see that day.
Yeah. But to close off, by-election updates. The federal government, as we know, hasn't announced the BC by-elections to come, but the leak this week was that they're considering announcing them so they will be held in February, so call them in January for a February race. This would mean Jagmeet Singh could finally try for his seat in Burnaby South, which Main Street Research released a poll saying he is in third place for. Well, not exactly. They actually asked which leader is most popular in that riding, and he was third. But it's still not good. There's also a race in Outremont, Tom Mulcair's old seat, which the NDP stand to lose because they're not doing great in Quebec.
Are they doing great anywhere?
There's also York Simcoe, where the Conservatives had a person, I believe, died. And so that seat has been vacant for a while. The other news is, of course, Nanaimo Ladysmith will probably be vacant at some point, we're assuming, because at some point Sheila Malcolmson is going to resign that seat, following whenever Leonard Krogh gets around resigning his seat. Do we assume that will be next week, Shannon?
That's the assumption, yes. Once the session was done, that Krogh would do the official resignation.
And the other seat to vacate federally is the Liberal for St. Leonard, St. Michel in Montreal, who is Nicola Di Iorio. Iorio? I don't know how to pronounce that. He's just been missing for months from Parliament. Apparently he said in the spring that he was resigning for personal reasons, but he never filed the paperwork. And then he took up a job with a law firm, and then he was spotted at some like cannabis expo.
Oh man, all these politicians getting into the legit weed business. Like,
yeah, but this guy was still sitting MP, yeah. And so he was collecting the dual salary and has finally been called out on it. And now he said he will resign on January 22nd, which is oddly not today.
Well, we also had another resignation at the federal level today, which adds an interesting twist to Jagmeet Singh's current situation. A Liberal MP resigned in Brampton East.
Yeah, that's Raj Gruel.
Yeah, so Singh used to hold a provincial Ontario seat in Brampton and had previously said that that would be ideal because it's, you know, like a home city for him. Now he's committed to running in Burnaby. He's had this poll showing that he comes in third of all the leaders. Does he maybe decide to wait it out until Trudeau decides to call another by-election or just run in the federal election next fall? I kind of doubt it, but it's an interesting wrinkle.
I think the NDP in Burnaby South has already done their nomination.
I think you're right.
Already? Yeah. And regardless, it's a really bad look to turn around and head back to Ontario with your tail between your legs, especially after making such a big showing of, you know, moving to Burnaby and everything.
On the other hand, how good of a look is it to be the federal leader of a party and be the third choice candidate in a by-election?
Both are bad.
Yeah.
It's much worse now than I think it used to be. John A. MacDonald actually lost one by-election and then had to like move to Victoria and quickly run
shame.
Again.
I don't think he ever visited Victoria. He
yeah. Oh, yeah.
Just
he didn't
ran
come out
there.
Here. He just put
absentee.
His name. Yeah. So back in those days, one didn't need to actually try to win, and you could lose a couple seats.
Back in those days, you also had to be a white man with probably quite a bit of money to even run at all. So
I mean, that doesn't hurt these days. Still
true.
One thing that complicates this for Jagmeet, if he did want to consider Brampton or Montreal for some reason, or even Nanaimo, is I guess it's actually in one of the new bills that the Liberals have brought forward, Bill C-76, which they're aiming to pass soon, and that's going to actually forbid the Prime Minister from calling a by-election within 9 months of the date of a fixed general election. I guess this is a way to just not waste anyone's time calling a by-election that someone then wins, and by the time they take their seat, they have like 2 or 3 weeks of sitting before it breaks. This bill, assuming it's passed, will set the cutoff date of January 20th for when the last by-election could be called, which means that if Sheila Malcolmson doesn't resign until after January 20th, which could happen, because she might not resign that seat, I take it, until she is elected or does her first sitting in Nanaimo provincially. And which one was it? This Montreal MP, who's not resigning until the 22nd, I guess his seat won't be up for a by-election. And it just complicates everything. But we will see at least the three by-elections in Burnaby, Outremont, and York Simcoe.
Yep.
And one of those is a sure thing, the Conservative one. But yeah, the other two will be interesting to watch.
This whole saga really, I think, shows how bad Jagmeet's strategy is of just not getting in the House and kind of just floating out there somewhere until a seat he kind of wanted open up, rather than go in the traditional route of having an MP in a safe seat step down.
He did manage to get the little graphic of his plane flying back and forth across the country for all the meetings he was going to and rallies, which also looked really bad from an environmental point of view. But he's not the Green leader. Going back to the Main Street research poll, there was one other interesting finding in there, whether you trust Main Street or not, that the provincial Nanaimo riding was effectively a dead heat between the Liberals' Tony Harris, I believe it is, and Sheila Malcolmson. So if that's true, that means it's a tighter race than anyone, I think, was really expecting.
And I know the Liberals are pouring everything they can into this because they want to flip the House back badly. So I expect we'll see a lot of their top talent out in Nanaimo.
It's very interesting, the sort of conversation around this by-election that hasn't even been called yet. Like, the Nanaimo by-election has not yet been called. Horgan has said he will do it soon. He will do it in time for Nanaimo to have an MLA in the House when the next budget comes out. That's coming up in February. But the campaigning has already begun, really, even though the by-election hasn't started yet. I got an email from Sheila Malcolmson about how wonderful it is that the NDP government is investing to build a new ICU for Nanaimo Regional General Hospital, which in 2013 was ranked by an independent report as one of the worst ICUs in the country, and the BC Liberals didn't do anything about it. So Sheila Malcolmson sort of pumping hard for the provincial NDP. At the same time, Harris has remarked several times that the NDP take Nanaimo for granted. You know, a safe riding, it's almost always been NDP. And has also remarked several times on the fact that Krogh, the current MLA, despite his sort of long service for the party, did not receive a cabinet post when Premier Horgan put his cabinet together. And so Harris has sort of been leveraging that as proof that, you know, the ruling party doesn't really care about Nanaimo as a riding.
Be an interesting one to watch.
Always. It's being, well, I've heard at least one person describe it as possibly the most significant by-election the province has ever seen.
I mean, that might actually be the case, because this could actually flip the House.
Well, it'll make things interesting, because it would tie...
It ties the House.
Ties the House.
So the Speaker would always be voting on legislation, which is very uncommon. Now, the tradition is for the Speaker to vote with the government. Typically, the Speaker is of the government. Our current Speaker is not. I would go out on a limb and venture that Plekis does not have a lot of fond feeling for his former party, and so might be somewhat inclined to maintain that tradition and vote with the government, but would be free to follow his conscience on any piece of legislation that pricks his conscience. So it could be very interesting if a Liberal MLA takes Nanaimo. Now, the Greens are planning to run a candidate there as well. They did do quite well there in the last election. I can't remember what their percentage of the vote was, but I think it's safe to say that the race is probably between a Liberal candidate and an NDP candidate, so we'll see.
That's at least what Main Street found.
Never a dull moment in BC politics. I was feeling a little bit sorry for myself like a couple of weeks ago, because there were some exciting things going, or crazy things going on in Ontario and Alberta, where we also have reporters, and I'm feeling like it's a little bit of be careful what you wish for. Because I'm certainly, I would say, the one reporting on the most exciting and baffling situation of the three provinces at the moment.
All right. Well, if people want to keep up with everything that's happening over the next few days and I guess the rest of the legislative session, where should they find you, Shannon?
Well, if you're looking for the purely political viewpoint, you can find me on Twitter at BC Today Official. If you're looking for maybe a little more color, a little more sass, or pictures of my beautiful cat, you can follow me at So Bitter So Sweet.
Yes, the cat thread is still going.
It is. Long live the cat thread.
And that has been Politos. Find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politos.ca. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Politos Pod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show.